I'm Marty Moscow-Wain. Welcome to Radio Times. A few days after the Trump administration indicated that the fate of Syrian President Assad was in the hands of the Syrian people, the regime reportedly used chemical weapons on civilians in a northern Syrian town, killing as many as 100 people. That was last Tuesday. The video of men, women, and children choking and foaming at the mouth was deeply disturbing. A few days later, President Trump ordered missile strikes on a Syrian airfield in retaliation. The next day, the Syrian-led bombing campaign against that town resumed, although apparently not with chemical weapons. Meanwhile, the aircraft carrier USS Carl Vinson is headed to the Korean Peninsula, where North Korea has been launching nuclear tests. President Trump has said that the U.S. is willing to act alone to remove that nuclear threat. Well, today on Radio Times, we want to talk about recent global events, how they are giving the Trump administration their first real test of foreign policy acumen. Joining us by telephone is Andrew Bacevich. He's an emeritus professor of history and international relations at Boston University, author of a number of books, including America's War for the Greater Middle East, A Military History. Andrew Bacevich, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Oh, thanks very much.
Also with us is James Kitfield. He's senior fellow at the Center for the Study of the Presidency and Congress, was a longtime foreign affairs correspondent, also author of a book, this one called Twilight Warriors, The Soldiers, Spies, and Special Agents Who Are Revolutionizing the American Way of War. And James Kitfield, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times, joining us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C.
Great to be with you.
James, let me begin with you. And obviously, Andrew Bacevich, I want you to weigh in as well. Looking at the airstrikes that were ordered last week, did they in any way, James Kitfield, hasten the end of the Civil War, stop the targeting of civilians, or even weaken the Assad regime?
Probably no in all three of those, actually. I think they were a very limited strike. You know, one air base was attacked with 59 cruise missiles. But it did send a message. I mean, you have to think about how outrageous the Assad regime's behavior was here. In 2013, President Obama, you know, got right up to the edge of defending his own red line against the use of chemical weapons against civilians when Assad killed more than 1,400 civilians with chemical weapons. And the only, you know, way out of that was a sort of a face-saving deal that Russia, organized to for Syria to, you know, remove all of its chemical weapons. Well, clearly it didn't remove all of its chemical weapons, and it has slowly started to be, you know, this wasn't the first instance, this one last week, but it was the most egregious. So that was really sort of a shot across America's bow that, you know, that deal was a hoax. And the Trump administration decided it couldn't sit by and not do anything about that, so it launched the strike. I don't think that they have, you know, gone to the point where a lot of neoconservatives and others would like, where that means that we're now engaged in regime change in Syria. I don't believe that's the case.
To you, Andrew Bacevich, picking up what James Kitfield just said, do you think there was a message that President Trump was trying to send?
Oh, I suppose there was. I mean, the problem with talking about messages and signals is it's difficult to know how the message is received or interpreted at the other end. I don't think we've seen any evidence thus far that the Assad regime is going to somehow become more compliant or peaceful. It could be that they will refrain from using chemical weapons to kill civilians. They'll merely continue to kill civilians using conventional weapons. So what that gets us, I don't know.
Well, picking up on that, Andrew Bacevich, why, and I feel sort of cold-hearted saying this because I watched those videos, and they are deeply disturbing as people were dying, gasping for breath. But why are those videos and the use of chemical weapons the reason for any kind of military strike? I'm thinking of all the things that we do not see, especially in Syria, that have been happening over the last 5 years.
Yeah, I don't think there's any rational explanation. I would say that this is a hangover from the First World War. That was when these weapons were introduced onto the battlefield, were used in a very large scale by both sides in the First World War, and had horrific effects. And since that time, I think there has evolved a set of norms, partly codified in law, but I think also more simply cultural norms that views chemical weapons as somehow beyond the pale. But I think your point is correct. I don't know if it's any worse to die as a result of a chemical weapons attack than to die, you know, bleeding in the streets with your body torn apart by a shrapnel from a conventional bomb or a conventional artillery round. Nonetheless, the perception that somehow chemical weapons are different retains a very strong hold.
Indeed. James, you want to weigh in on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's useful to have norms against the use of weapons of mass destruction. We have norms against the use of chemical weapons. It's codified in the Chemical Weapons Convention. It's codified in numerous UN resolutions. We have norms against use of biological weapons. We have norms against the use of nuclear weapons. And I think those norms are very important. I think that this, if what we said after World War I and after the Holocaust was never again, you know, to stand by and let a guy gas his own civilians and do nothing, I think would be sending a message that anything goes and no one's going to, any bad actor, and there are a lot of bad actors acting very badly right now, can do so with impunity. So I think it's a useful, although it does beg the question, you know, does it make any difference if you're going to let them barrel bomb their own civilians? You know, I would wish there could be an international consensus against that as well, but that does not exist right now, mainly because the Russians and Iranians are involved in Syria. But at least there is a consensus, I think, around the use of not using chemical weapons.
Let me pick up on a couple of things. I'll toss this back to you, James Kitfield. Clearly the president was moved by those images and the videos of people suffering and choking to death, essentially. Just wondering about how to reconcile that with the clear suffering of the Syrian people who, at least the White House has tried to prevent from coming to the United States through some kind of refugee policy. Can we reconcile that? Or
no,
can you reconcile that?
No,
go ahead.
I cannot reconcile that, and I think it's an absolutely sends a terrible signal, and I don't think we should have this ban on Syrian refugees. I think I know for a fact in talking to people from our allies that it is a stain on our reputation. So I can't reconcile that. Now, the Trump is an interesting question in my mind. Is Trump, like a month ago, basically asked the State Department and Defense Department to look into the issue of establishing a safe zone in Syria that civilians could go to, that they would be safe from barrel bombs and from being gassed, et cetera. I'm very, very interested if that is the next step here. That obviously is a much greater commitment, a lot heavier lift. But that would be at least rational response to someone who's killing his own people would say, okay, these people, refugees, come here. You'll be safe in this safe zone that we create.
And you're saying that would be a further involvement then in the United States in this civil war?
Absolutely, it would be. It would be definitely taking another major step of involvement. You know, you have to, your listeners should understand that we currently have, you know, more than 1,000 troops on Syrian soil. We have Marine artillery units and Black Hawk, Apache helicopters. We have, you know, those are involved in the fight against ISIS. Now with the strike against the Syrian regime, I mean, we are involved in the Syrian conflict, but we're involved more or less in the margins of it. Establishing a safe zone would be a major step of involvement, no doubt about it.
Andrew Bacevich, what do you think about a no-fly zone in Syria?
Well, I mean, I think it begs the question, toward what end? I mean, what is the objective here? Is the objective ultimately to bring about regime change in Damascus? And that would imply the United States shouldering what sort of obligations? I think those are huge questions that really ought to be addressed before we go any further down this path of greater U.S. military involvement.
The president, both as a business person and as a candidate and now as president, Andrew, has said many different things, some of which contradict themselves, about how the U.S. or how and when the United States would get involved in a war. And in this particular war itself, how do you wrestle with the various, frankly, contradictory things that he has said?
Well, I don't know what you mean by wrestle with. There's no question that it is becoming increasingly difficult to identify what, if any, principles are used to guide this administration's approach to the world. It appeared that Trump, as a candidate, and in the first couple of weeks of his presidency, that this phrase "America First" was going to be the beacon that would serve as a guide, and that's gone by the board. This morning, somebody called my attention to a statement made, I think, within the last 24 hours by Secretary of State Tillerson, in which he says, I'll quote, "We dedicate ourselves to holding to account any and all who commit crimes against the innocents anywhere in the world." Now, that is an extraordinary statement, and to the extent that Secretary Tillerson speaks for the administration, and who knows if indeed he does, then his statement would suggest that America First is gone, and we are somewhere back where George W. Bush was in the immediate wake of 9/11, where we are called upon to police planet Earth, and to do so not from the point of view of geopolitical calculations, but to do so from the point of view of moral imperatives. Again, I don't know what that means. There sure the heck are a lot of innocents being victimized by a lot of crimes in lots of parts of the world, and you got to wonder, first of all, what Tillerson implies, but you also then have to wonder how a statement like that plays in the rest of the world. I think you want to get to talk about North Korea. How do North Korean officials interpret a statement like that? And how, therefore, will a statement like that affect the calculation of a regime such as North Korean? So I find this transformation of sort of the rhetorical position that this administration has taken to be, frankly, bizarre, but also deeply troubling in terms of its potential implications.
James, we're almost up in a break here, and we have some clips we want to play as well, but I'm just curious about the word that the president uses is a flexibility when it comes to foreign policy. Is that a foreign policy, to be flexible?
It's his foreign policy. I think it has great, there's lots of things wrong with a very inconsistent foreign policy, because it leaves both your adversaries and your allies guessing about what you will do. What you really want is, in foreign policy, is a bit more certainty, so your allies and your adversaries kind of understand where their bright lines are that they can't go over. And I'm with Andrew in taking kind of umbrage this idea that we are going to be sort of the enforcer of all, norms against people who, act against human rights. However, the American people elected this guy. We knew that he was very flexible in terms of his positions on stances, and so here we have it again.
That's James Kitfield, senior fellow at the Center for the Study of the Presidency and Congress. Also with us, Andrew Bacevich. He's emeritus professor of history and international relations at Boston University. We are talking about the foreign policy tests of the Trump administration. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Give us a call to join the conversation. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with Andrew Bacevich and James Kitfield about the missile strike that was ordered last week by President Trump in response to President Assad's sarin gas attack on Syrian civilians. That civil war continues after a number of years and millions of people displaced. I think something like 200,000 people who have died in that conflict. Also, we'll be talking about North Korea and the growing, increasingly confrontation with their military displays. And again, you can join our conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. I see emails coming in, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me play a couple of clips. And this is from yesterday's Sunday TV talk shows. The first one is Secretary of State Rex Tillerson. He appeared on CBS Face the Nation. Let's give that a listen.
It's important that we keep our priorities straight, and we believe that the first priority is the defeat of ISIS, that by defeating ISIS and removing their caliphate from their control, we have now eliminated at least or minimized a particular threat, not just to the United States, but to the whole stability in the region. And once the ISIS threat has been reduced or eliminated, I think we can turn our attention directly to stabilizing the situation in Syria.
And this is Lieutenant General H.R. McMaster. He appeared on Fox News Sunday yesterday, also talking about the attack on the Syrian air base.
And so what's significant about this strike is not that it was meant to take out the Syrian regime's capacity or ability to commit mass murder of its own people, but it was to be a very strong signal to Assad and his sponsors that the United States cannot stand idly by as he is murdering innocent civilians.
And the final one, this is the U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Nikki Haley, and she was on CNN yesterday.
There's not any sort of option where a political solution is going to happen with Assad at the head of the regime. It just, if you look at his actions, if you look at the situation, it's going to be hard to see a government that's peaceful and stable with Assad.
Andrew Bacevich, three members of the Trump administration saying three different things, a little bit overlapping, but nonetheless three different things. And we haven't heard much from the president himself on this issue. Is it important to have a quote-unquote foreign policy, a predictable foreign policy?
Yes, it is. You don't even have to put the quotes on it.
Okay.
It's really, really important, I think. To be able to
my ignorance there, but no, go ahead.
No, I'm just joking.
No, I got
but
you.
It seems to me it is crucially important to state a set of principles, even if those principles at some level come across as cliches or platitudes. But at least to have an azimuth, as James said a little while ago, communicated to adversaries and allies alike. That this is where we think we're headed. And those quotes that you just played and any number of other statements that we could cite suggest that there are no principles that guide this administration. In a sense, you'd say, well, that's not surprising because the president himself, during the course of his campaign, over the course of his entire adult life, has given little evidence of somebody who does adhere to a set of identifiable principles. We use the term flexible in reference to him and his actions a couple of minutes ago. I think that's being too kind. It's impetuous. It's opportunistic. It's inconsistent. That's Trump. And sadly, I think those are the terms that best apply to Trump's administration as it unfolded up to this point.
James, it seems that there is at least some consensus, knowing how complicated things are in Syria and its neighbors in the Middle East. But it seems that defeating ISIS is the goal that Russia's and Assad, the United States and others can all agree on. Is that possible? And would defeating ISIS then bring about some ability to stabilize the region?
Well, you can defeat ISIS. At least you can defeat it as what it is now, which is a sort of insurgent army that occupies territory, you know, roughly between Mosul and Raqqa. We're well on the way to doing that, as a matter of fact. I think Mosul will probably fall in the next month or so, and Raqqa sometime this year probably. So it will lose its grip on power. I think that's a very positive thing. Question is, can you leverage that, as Secretary Tillerson said, to, you know, stabilize Syria more largely? And that gets to this question of, you know, what becomes of Assad. And in that case, it's really kind of head-spinning to have Secretary Tillerson say early in the week that we have no particular equity in whether Assad stays or goes for the Syrian people to do. And then after this incident, the UN ambassador is saying Assad basically must go. I mean, that sends very different signals to, like I said, our adversaries and our allies alike. We should try to be a little bit more consistent. Some of this is it's a new administration. You got in Tillerson someone who's not a diplomat. But really what you say does matter. I mean, when President Obama said, you know, Assad, there's no place for Assad in the future of Syria many, many years ago, and did nothing to back that up. That sent a message when he said it to the Syrian rebels that, you know, that America kind of stands behind you. And that wasn't the case. And so, you know, when you say something from the positions that these people now occupy, people listen and those words have meaning. And to have them to be so conflicting, again, sends a very sort of inconsistent message. McMaster, I think, was trying to leverage this strike to say to Assad, you know, you have to worry if you keep you know, murdering civilians with barrel bombs, that we might find that to be over a red line too. You know, that to me is probably smart. You want to leverage what you've done here to the maximum impact. And if you can make him guess or worry about his future actions, that would be helpful. But this issue of, you know, does Assad go or stay, that's fundamental to our approach to this crisis.
Why do you think, Andrew, Assad, and we're assuming it's Assad, but why did he launch this chemical attack on his own civilians?
I don't know. I mean, I truly don't have a good explanation for that. I mean, my sense is that, as a distant observer, that the war has been going his way of late, in considerable part, I think, thanks to the efforts of the Russians. And so why he would choose this particular moment to violate those norms, that taboo against chemical weapons, doesn't make a whole heck of a lot of sense to me. And I just don't know. Maybe James has an insight.
Yeah, what do you think? Do you have any thoughts on that, James?
Well, I'm equally baffled by it. It was horrible strategy the same week that our Secretary of State basically for the first time says, you know, it's not in our interest whether or not Assad comes or goes. So that should be he should take some uplift from that. And then to that very week to poke his finger in our eye with this chemical weapons attack is not strategically sound thinking, but he's no strategic genius. I think why he did it was, as Andrew said, he feels like he's on the verge of victory here. The military situation has been going his way for quite some time, and I think that he wants to send the message that, you know, finally give up this fight, rebels. There's no one who will support you. Your cause is lost. You know, surrender. And this would be, you know, a way to show that. But I think he overplayed his hand.
I mean, another thought. I mean,
sure.
I have just committed this fallacy, and it's the fallacy of examining or trying to assess an action in wartime and work from the assumption that there must be some rational explanation, that somebody intended this act to occur. In thinking of war more broadly, it's any war is filled with events and episodes and occurrences that are unintended, that are part of the fog and friction of war. I'm not trying to argue that does apply in this instance, but it could be that what occurred does not actually reflect the intended actions of President Assad.
Let me read a couple of email comments that we've gotten. One from Todd in Vineland. He said, is the world just going to sit by as a country and tyrant uses chemical weapons? This is genocide. Someone, the USA, has to draw the red line. Andrew Bacevich, you agree with that?
Well, the world stands by when all kinds of horrific things are happening. You know, we are preoccupied right now with events in Syria, and in a sense it's understandable because we had a direct hand in the events that have occurred. But there's horrific events happening in Yemen. There's horrific events happening elsewhere in Europe. Horrific events happen every day in North Korea, where a population has been oppressed by a terrible regime for decades now. And the blanket statement, you know, that the world must act, it seems to me, is understandable, I think, from an emotional sense. But when you try to think about, well, what happens next? You know, what are steps 2, 3, and 4? Where does this lead us? What may be some of the unintended consequences? Then it seems to me, if you're a policymaker, it might be important to take a deep breath, stop, think a little bit before just pulling the trigger because you find some particular episode to be outrageous. Even granting that the episode, such as this gas attack, is outrageous.
Let me read an email from Greg. I'll put this to you, James. He says, it's unfair to sum up Trump's entire foreign policy by a single condolence offered in a difficult time. And yes, we're less than 100 days into the Trump administration. He is clearly being tested, as I'm assuming if Hillary Clinton won, she would be tested as well. But is this being unfair to the president?
Well, I mean, actually, he's gotten more positive reviews for this strike in Syria than anything he's done since he's been president, with the possible exception of last week's confirmation of Judge Gorsuch. So I think in this instance, I think he's actually getting pretty good reviews. You're right. Every president is tested, and they're almost all tested early in their first year in office. I've written about that, and this is clearly his first big test. But everyone reads into how presidents do in that first test. And you know, again, I think the reviews have been fairly good. But all of these things beg the question of what next? How do you leverage this? What is your plan? What's your strategy? What happens the day after? And I'm not sure they have really good answers to all of that. But as far as first tests go, I think this has probably been a pretty good one for him.
Let me throw in another wrinkle here. This is, of course, Russia, the role of Russia, its relationship with Assad, the fact that over the campaign and even as President Trump has uttered nary a critical word of Putin and Russia, obviously we are on the same side of Russia in this fight against ISIS. But James Gidfill, how do we factor then Russia in? And are we back to the kind of tense relationship we've had with that country in administrations past?
I would say worse relationship, yes.
Okay.
And by the way, Russia's really not engaged in the anti-ISIS fight. That's their sort of ruse to sort of say we're coming in to fight the terrorists. But their terrorists are the other legitimate, we think, rebels who oppose Assad because they started out as peaceful demonstrators and got massacred. So Russia really has done nothing to fight ISIS, at least in Syria. Clearly the Trump administration, certainly when Mike Flynn was National Security Advisor, had a plan to align with Russia against ISIS as a way to sort of break what has been a downward spiral in our relations with Russia. That's strategically perfectly sound to do. You don't want the world's two superpowers to be at loggerheads all over the world, and which is what kind of we have a very adversarial relationship. I think it's worse than some points in the Cold War, at least the Cold
really?
War.
Absolutely.
Wow. They have put in doctrine that opposing the United States and NATO is we are their adversaries. They are working against our interests throughout the world, especially in Europe, especially in their meddling of our elections, something you never saw to this degree during the Cold War. They would never have dared. So Russia and the U.S. are at a Cold War-like sort of relationship now, and it's going to be very hard for me to see how Tillerson turns that around, but I hope Syria is the place where we can break this spiral. Again, I don't think this administration is particularly concerned whether Assad stays or go, but they do want a ceasefire. They do want this civil war to stop or be frozen somehow, and that's in Russia's interest, too. They are extended in Syria, and they didn't go in thinking it would be a very long, drawn-out operation, so there may be some alignment there.
Andrew, Tillerson is on his way. He's in Italy today, and he's on his way to Russia, to Moscow tomorrow. Is it important to figure out how to either repair this relationship or make it a more functional relationship?
Well, yeah. I mean, I'd like to repair the relationship to some degree, but I think, if we recall that one of the cornerstones of Trump's candidacy with regard to foreign policy was that he was going to establish some kind of a warm personal relationship with President Putin that would lead to cordial relations between the United States and Russia. It seems to me that prospect is gone. It ain't going to happen. I think I would disagree with James a little bit in his characterization of us now being in something akin to a new Cold War. From my point of view, I would emphasize that Russia is simply not the Soviet Union in any sense, whether we're talking geographic expanse, ideological sort of underpinnings, size of the economy. President Obama famously discounted Russia as what he called a regional power, and I think that actually gets it right. They're not a peer of the United States of America. They are troublesome. They are engaging in provocative behavior. We should stand firm against that kind of stuff, but I don't think we're headed to a Cold War. The problem with reviving the notion of a Cold War pitting the United States against Russia, one problem is that it seems to me it overlooks a potentially adversarial relationship that is actually far, far more important, and that's the relationship between ourselves and the People's Republic of China. Huh. That's where, that part of the world is where I think the fate of the planet in a geopolitical sense is likely to be determined. So I'm a heck of a lot more worried about what goes on in Asia than I am what goes on between ourselves and Russia.
In fact, we'll be talking about that after we take a break, and we have about a minute or so here. James, let me toss something from Paul, who tweeted at us. He said, Trump saw a chance to help his low ratings, and he took it. And that's not the first time I have seen that analysis or a perspective on what President Trump did last week. Do you think there's some truth to that?
I think, you know, I'm willing to give him the benefit of the doubt just because the events kind of drove this. Well, he didn't pick the timing of this. You know, I don't think he would have actually chosen to have to do this while, you know, the president, the head of China is visiting Mar-a-Lago. So I don't think that's the case. It's the wag. I mean, I've heard this wag the dog stuff, too. If he thought that, certainly his military chain of command wouldn't have gone along with it if they thought that was what this was around. And I didn't sense any sort of resistance to taking this action from either Secretary of Defense Mattis or for H.R. McMaster. So I don't really believe that's true.
You see the fingerprints of his military advisors on this?
Very much so.
Do you, Andrew Bacevich?
Oh, yes, I do. I mean, one of the things that I think as observers we're all curious about is how the administration is going to shake down in terms of which are the voices that are most influential in shaping President Trump's view of things. His preference for appointing senior military officers was already pretty evident, not just Mattis and McMaster, but the head of Homeland Security. And it does seem to be that the generals are going to carry a lot of weight, and I myself find that troubling.
Well, I want to pick up on that as well. That's Andrew Bacevich joining us along with James Kitfield. We are talking about U.S. foreign policy, the challenges of the last couple of weeks. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. If you're just joining us, we are talking about Syria, the civil war in Syria, and last week's call by President Trump to send in missile strikes on a Syrian airfield in retaliation for alleged chemical attacks on a small town, or a town, I should say, in northern Syria. I do want to talk about Korea, the aircraft carrier USS Carl Vinson heading to the Korean Peninsula, where North Korea has been launching nuclear tests. And just to reiterate, President Trump did say that the U.S. was willing to act alone to remove that nuclear threat. And again, our guests are James Kitfield. He's a senior fellow at the Center for the Study of the Presidency and Congress, was a longtime foreign affairs correspondent, wrote a book called Twilight Warriors. Also with us, Andrew Bacevich, an emeritus professor of history and international relations at Boston University. And his latest book is called America's War for the Greater Middle East. And we got a lot of comments here. Let me just throw Korea on the table for discussion. And Andrew Bacevich, you said, you said you were much more worried about what's happening in Asia than what's happening in the Middle East.
Yes, and certainly Korea is part of that in an immediate sense. Korea is part of that worry. You know, I don't think there's anything unusual about the United States military gesturing, exercising, in and around Korea. So sending an aircraft carrier there in some senses is no big deal. What makes it a big deal is that we've had, again, Secretary Tillerson announce that the policy of so-called strategic patience vis-a-vis North Korea is now defunct. Statements made to the effect that all options are on the table. That's always kind of a code that says that will consider the use of military force. And so in the wake of the Syria strike, which came out of nowhere, put yourself in the shoes of Kim Jong-un and ask yourself then, well, what are the Americans up to when they send this aircraft carrier into Korean waters? I don't know what he thinks, but it seems to me that when you combine U.S. actions with U.S. rhetoric, there's a potential for us to elicit a response that is quite a bit different than the response we might want. You know, we've had stability on the Korean Peninsula ever since 1953. It's been imperfect, that's for sure. But at least there has been, we've managed to avoid a war, and I'm a little bit concerned that the words, more than the actions, the words of the Trump administration may put that stability at risk.
Well, James, it's pretty clear that North Korea will most likely launch another nuclear test. Is that a test then of what the U.S. and the Trump administration will do, especially with this aircraft carrier that's kind of moving into the region?
Yeah, and they've been testing us like this, and that this testing of us has accelerated pretty dramatically. I do worry that the link between this and the Syria case, where Trump took his first serious military action last week and got pretty good reviews, and decided very quickly to go down that route. I hope we know that this person. President Trump is very mercurial and impulsive, and I shudder to think if he's mercurial and impulsive in dealing with North Korea, because it's a much more serious issue. They have just conventionally the ability to basically wipe Seoul off the map with artillery.
Wow.
So that's poised at the DMZ, which is only 30 miles from the South Korean capital. So you have to be very careful. But on Andy's point about we've had stability on the peninsula for since the 50s. That's true, but what's changing in the equation is there'll come a day, and it looks, you can now see in the approaching horizon, probably 5 years to 10 years, where Korea probably could plausibly threaten to take out Los Angeles with an ICBM armed with a nuclear missile. I have never talked to anyone who is currently or before in the government who wants to live in a world where this bellicose, very unstable hermit king can threaten to take out an American city with a nuclear weapon. You don't want to get into that kind of brinksmanship, because we don't know if mutually assured destruction really works with an actor like this. So it's, to me, a very scary prospect where they're headed, and that's why everyone's taking it so seriously.
Well, it sounds like that's an argument for taking out his nuclear capabilities then, however you can do that.
It is, and so preemption has never been off the table for any president. Bill Clinton went right up to the brink of that, and the North Koreans backed down, but they thought it was that serious themselves that they contemplated a preemptive strike. The problem is the one I just mentioned. Even if they don't have a usable nuclear weapon, and we can't assume that they don't, they have conventionally, we would win that conflict, but it would be so destructive, and it'd be very hard to get the South Koreans on board for something preemptive if the capital of South Korea could be raised in the first weeks of that conflict.
But it seems, Andrew, that China does not want a nuclear-armed North Korea next door.
Well, I mean, of course, and this is, I think, the default American policy position, to include for people like me. We don't want to have a war, so why can't the Chinese go solve this problem for us? And I think most observers believe that China has sufficient leverage to not necessarily determine, but at least influence the behavior of the North Korean regime. From the Chinese perspective, they might say, "Oh yeah, well, what's in it for us?" And there, I think you end up with the North Korean problem being part of the much larger circumstance that I was alluding to a couple of minutes ago, and that is to say, what will be the new order in the Asia-Pacific region as China continues its rise to the status of great power, of becoming, in many respects, virtually a peer of the United States of America? And that's obviously another issue that probably would take a whole another hour to discuss, but the North Korean conundrum, I think, is a part of that larger question of the direction of relations in the Asia-Pacific region.
Let me just read a couple of comments here, and then we've got some people that want to join our conversation. We won't be able to do justice to all these comments, but they're interesting. One from Cyril who says, should we really be policing the world on international law and morality? That's one question out there. A tweet from HJ, what is the Russian response to the American strike in regards to the color revolutions in Georgia and Ukraine? That's worth another hour as well. An email from Nick in South Philly, if Trump's actions in Syria is not deemed impulsive, what was the immediate urgency? Was it legal? What circumstances warranted that he just notify instead of consult with members of Congress and the international community? That, too, is another important question. But let me go to some of our callers here. And this is Eddie from Ocean City joining us on Radio Times. Eddie, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You're welcome.
I just want to say, terrorism is extremely damaging to our psyche, and it's horrifying, but I think these type of conflicts with states are so much more dangerous, and they have no end. If we get involved, we start to be within the state, and it becomes like a trap for us as a nation, and resources are out the window, and the conflict can continue to grow. And even after you defeat them, you're still there, and you have to police them, and they lose so many. Like Assad has taken out more lives than all the terrorism in probably a decade, within a year or two. And I just see this as such a slippery slope and so dangerous.
Well, I appreciate the call, Eddie, to Radio Times. James, you want to take that? And there is the slippery slope worry, I think, that especially with Syria and how complicated the Middle East is, and also Iraq and Libya and other countries there as well, that we're just going to get drawn into a unwinnable war.
Well, I mean, it's a natural concern for a country that's gotten drawn into two decade-plus very unsatisfactory wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. We could spend a whole show on that. But you should be very, very reluctant to get involved in another state business. But, I would also argue, though, that we saw with Syria, because for 3 or 4 years the Obama administration basically took a hands-off approach to Syria, that there are costs when states start to fail in a very violent way in a very complicated region. We've seen that with Syria. There's all kinds of repercussions, including a immigration crisis that's destabilized Western Europe and destabilized a lot of our allies in the region, and the rise of the most virulent and powerful terrorist group the world's ever seen. So there are costs to all of this, and everyone looks to America for leadership because that is the role that we've assumed for the last basically half century plus. So it's a complicated world, and you have to be very reluctant, but also there are costs to doing nothing.
Andrew Bacevich, Donald Trump has said that we, meaning the United States, don't win wars anymore. And certainly you look back over the last couple of decades. You served in the Vietnam War. You're a retired Army colonel. Is there some truth to that?
Well, I think it's very true that if you look at the panoply of U.S. military interventions in the Middle East, broadly defined, whether we're talking about Iraq, Syria today, whether we're talking about Afghanistan, the longest war in our history, whether you look at Somalia, Yemen, other places, Libya, that we've been involved, we have undertaken these efforts knowing that we have the world's finest military. Yes, indeed, we do. But we have in no case, in no instance, despite having spent huge sums of money, suffered substantial casualties, in no instance have we succeeded in achieving our political purposes in anything like a conclusive manner. To put it simply, we haven't won. So the charge is correct. I think the larger question is, why not? Why haven't we won? Big question. Lots of factors would pertain, but I do think that the most important one, where we need to face up to, is that the intervention by outside powers in that region of the world is simply not going to produce a political outcome. Our meddling has been a source of disorder and of chaos, rather than a response or a way to fix disorder. And I think that the beginning of wisdom is to acknowledge that failure.
James, your book is really about the special forces and others who are in many ways on the front line of the wars that we're involved in.
Right. I would just like a point.
Sure, go ahead.
Andy and I know each other well enough to know we disagree somewhat on this, but I thought our intervention after the massacre of 7,000 civilians in Srebrenica during the Bosnian wars was successful. We wanted that crisis to have a peaceful ending, and it has held. So I think that was successful. I think the first Gulf War was pretty successful when Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait. So I take the point. I think Afghanistan might have been successful if we hadn't taken our eye off the ball and invaded Iraq. So, again, you have to think very hard about these interventions, but you also have to think about what the world looks like when you don't intervene. Do you just let a Rwanda happen and do nothing like we did? President Clinton saw this, came to think that of his worst mistake of his presidency. So these are agonizingly difficult questions. But again, a world without America playing a leadership role and trying to enforce some norms in the world becomes a very ugly Darwinian place pretty quickly.
Let me get Sam from Atlantic City to join our conversation. And Sam, go ahead. You are on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. Thanks so much for having me on.
Sure, no problem.
I'm glad you said something about alleged chemical attack, and I'm sure there was an attack, a chemical attack, but I'm reading some sources are saying that the rebels themselves did the attack to really make Assad look worse than he is, and that's the first thing. The second thing is the Israelis used white phosphorus back in 2006 and 2012, 13, and 14, and white phosphorus is a deadly chemical weapon, and where is the double standard? And if this were back in 1967 on June 8th, I don't want to be anti-Semitic. It has nothing to do with anti-Semitic. Where is the double standard when the Israeli Air Force attacked our USS Liberty?
Well, you know what, Sam? Only because we're almost out of time here, but I want to pick up on the first thing you said about alleged attack. And there is Andrew Bacevich. Whether I'm not sure if it's true or not, that there's a theory that this was the rebels using them on their own people or on civilians so that Assad would get blamed for it.
I'm familiar with the theory. The theory is very, very plausible. The only problem with the theory, at least as far as I can tell, that there's no evidence to support it. So we would need some evidence. I think the double standards issue is very important.
Sure.
My allusion would be to the Vietnam War. Where we use chemical weapons all over the place. Agent Orange is a chemical weapon, and it's not a chemical weapon that simply affects plants. It affects people, to include our own veterans. And yet, as far as the United States is concerned, we chose to say that Agent Orange was not a chemical weapon. So there is an element of hypocrisy in all this. There's no question about it.
Sam, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. We're almost out of time here. James, I'll give you the last word. Tillerson is heading on. He's going to be in Moscow tomorrow. What do you hope he talks about? Apparently he's not meeting with Putin, but meeting with his counterpart.
Well, I mean, I think Syria is going to be the number one. I mean, the Russians have equities in Syria. Now we have equities in Syria. Syria has been the gaping wound in international relations for the last 5 or 6 years, just horrific carnage. I think that should be, the place where they try to focus on finding some alignment of our interest to get at least freeze that conflict in place. And I hope he sends a pretty strong message that, this downward spiral in U.S.-Russian relations, drawn to its logical conclusion, is going to be in neither one of ours' interest.
Well, James Kitfield, thank you once again for joining us today in Radio Times. I really appreciate it.
Great to be with you.
Nice to have you with us. And he's senior fellow at the Center for the Study of the Presidency and Congress. His most recent book is called Twilight Warriors, The Soldier Spies and Special Agents Who Are Revolutionizing the American Way of War. Andrew Bacevich, thank you very much as well.
Oh, thanks a lot.
You're welcome. An emeritus professor of history and international relations at Boston University, author of a number of books, including America's War for the Greater Middle East, A Military History, and he is a retired Army colonel. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.